Hi everyone, welcome to the Corporate Chat podcast. Your hosts today are Émile Journet and myself, Cédric Nadeau. We're both studying finance at McGill University. Thank you to Red Bull for sponsoring the episode. Our guest today is Mathieu Savary, Chief Strategist Europe at BCA Research, where he started his career as a database technician after graduating from McGill with a Bachelor's of Commerce degree. In this episode, we cover Mr. Savary's background and advice for current students, but also discuss the geopolitical and economic landscapes, including key challenges and opportunities for the European markets in coming years. Although this discussion was recorded earlier this winter, before the recent trade war developments, it offers extremely valuable insight into the current situation and Europe's position within the complex landscape. Without further ado, here is our discussion with Mathieu Savary.
Hi, Mr. Savary, how are you today?
I'm doing great, thank you very much.
Perfect, so we'll jump right into it. First of all, I'd love to hear about your background and how you ended up as a Chief European Strategist at BCA.
Well, it was quite an adventure. My background is linked. I studied finance and economics at McGill from 2000 to 2004. Then I first joined the firm where I work today, BCA Research, as an analyst, just conducting building models, conducting statistical analysis, all in the aim of forecasting markets, policy, and so on, using a macro lens. So that was my starting point, and it came from my interest. I always liked economics, I liked finance, I like politics, all of that mixes together when you're doing macro investing. So there was a lot of interest there. So I did that for a while. Then I worked for a period of time at a US fund manager, Brandywine Global Investment, which was a Philadelphia-based fund. I worked in their internal macro hedge fund, helping them build strategies to take advantage of volatility, which back in those days, there was a European sovereign debt crisis, was very high. So we spent a lot of time putting position on the euro, on Italian bonds, Italian banks, and so on, which were all in a period of tumult. So I did that for a while. Then I went back to BCA, where I started focusing more on currencies. I always thought currencies were fascinating because they are a pure macro instrument, very little accounting related knowledge. I mean, I did my CFA, I have all of that, but it's not what I enjoy the most. And I started covering currencies that way. And it was very fun. I did that for a while. I ended up becoming the head of our currency department at BCA Research. So, you know, advising hedge funds, banks, investment managers with their currency positions. And then within BCA later on, the colleague who used to cover Europe wanted to take another direction. And within the firm, I was the best candidate to start to cover European markets in aggregate. Because culturally, I'm born in France, I have a better cultural understanding of Europe than someone that lived their entire life in North America. And even more importantly, the bulk of G10 currency pairs are European currency pairs. You're talking about the euro, the Swiss franc, the Swedish krona, the Norwegian krone, the pound. So my knowledge of European economics was quite strong to begin with. So that's how I ended up covering the entirety of European market. It was a bit of an accident of life, if you will, but informed with my background, which was very fitting for that.
You mentioned that you were born in France. I'm just curious, why did you decide to come over in Canada and pursue a career here?
To a large degree, it was because of McGill. I wanted to study away from home. I had a bit of a rebellious streak when I was a teenager. I also wanted to learn English because back then, at least, the French educational system may have been good in math, but was pretty dismal at teaching French. So I wanted to know English very well. And I figured that being in Montreal, if I did prove to be incapable of learning English, I could fall on my feet. So ultimately, that's how I ended up here, and I ended up staying in Montreal because back in when I graduated in 2004, the job market in France was disastrous. I could have gotten a job in a bank, but it would have been like a post-graduation internship for 2 years with minimal pay, etc. While staying in Montreal, I could get the same job with a decent paycheck. So for me, the math was very simple. On top of it, I met a girl at McGill, who I'm married to now, so that also created another reason why I ended up staying.
So you mentioned preferring currencies, maybe to its focus, which is less on accounting, but you also studied finance and economics. What really drew you to pursue a career in economics specifically?
Well, I've always liked economics a lot. I've always thought it was a fascinating topic. And honestly, I got really good grades in economics with very limited effort. So I realized that I understood it very well. And but I also loved finance and I love derivatives and all that kind of stuff. And there is a lot of derivatives application on macro variable, whether it's rates, FX, equity indices, and so on. So when I found an opportunity to work in the macro space, but remaining like investment related, I didn't want to do something that is just policy or, you know, working at StatCan, something like that. I wasn't into that idea. I wanted to do something that was market related. And there was this golden opportunity that happened to be right here in Montreal to do exactly that. And originally I did not know what BCA research was. And I had a very good relationship with my derivatives professor, a guy called Pierre Ruiz, who I talked to him and I was like, okay, I don't know this firm. Rep seems decent. And he was like, oh, I know them. Like, he used to be an option trader for JP Morgan. And he told me, no. If you want to learn about economics and the interplay with market, this is probably the best place you can go to. So I jumped on the occasion. And indeed, the learning I've done was tremendous and greatly enjoyed it.
Yeah, so like you mentioned, you started here with BCA, and then you made your way up the firm. You progressed a lot. What did you think was key to your progression in the firm?
Honestly, it's a few things. The first one is curiosity. As I've highlighted, I had a deep interest for markets and for economics. So it meant that my brain was always excited to look at various topics that were highly relevant to what we cover at BCA, highly relevant in terms of making investment calls, and this combination worked super well. So that's factor number one, curiosity and deep love for market. Factor number two, I kind of pooped on the French education system earlier in terms of English. But the French education system also equipped me with a very good level of mathematics. So I was always very good at math, and that also helped me a lot in my career. I never struggled with stats or math, and I was always able to apply it well and accurately, which kind of made me shine from that perspective. And the third ingredient, which is not a surprise, is simply grinding. It's just no matter where you go in finance, if you want to be successful in that job, you need to be willing to put on the hours. And ultimately, that's why I put curiosity first. It's a lot easier to put in the hours if you like what you're doing and you have some natural talent at it, that if it's a struggle on either the interest you have for the topic, or even if it's a struggle because, you know, some of the concepts are hard to grasp, if it's easier to grasp, you're going to be able to progress more easily.
And so talking about putting in the work, how would you say your work-life balance has evolved throughout your career, and how would you describe it now?
It really depends when you talk to me. So when I was younger and starting my career, like pretty much every finance graduate would make a career in finance or consulting, there was no work-life balance. It was mostly work, 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 work. Now I'm much more senior, so I can have period where my work-life balance is better than it was, but also because my job is client-facing, ultimately I advise clients, I write documents, I do a lot of media intervention, and I spend a lot of time on the phone or traveling talking to clients. Sometimes it's even worse than it was. Like when you are on the road, there is no work-life balance. It's work, 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 work. When there is a crisis affecting European markets, I'm at the disposal, literally, of my clients constantly. So in those moments, there is no work-life balance. But overall, I would say it has improved, but there are spikes right now that can happen where it's even more skewed toward work than when I was younger, but those are temporary, which is definitely better overall.
And you mentioned your job being a lot client-facing.
Yeah.
How did you improve your communication skills throughout your career?
Oh, it's like everything else. It's practice, practice, practice. There is no secret. Sure, you know, at BCA, it's always, communication is a big part of what we do, since we advise, you know, sovereign wealth fund, hedge funds, long-only investors, family office, and all that kind of stuff. You need to stand out in the very crowded field of other consultants and advisors. Your communication needs to be efficient and punchy. So from the get-go, BCA invested in training me as well as other rising people in the firm in terms of writing. So I've literally taken some writing classes and some speaking classes and so on. But that's really just a small part of it. It is about practicing, practicing, and more practicing. And some of the stuff you have to do to get better aren't comfortable. Like, it is a good method to record yourself when you do a presentation and listen to yourself. And it's really terribly awkward thing to do, to listen to yourself. But then you see when you have weird speaking tics, what you can arrange and so on. And also listen to people that have a lot more experience than you in terms of both writing and speaking publicly. They can provide you a lot of feedback, and you need a bit of humility and take those feedback, because sometimes it can be a bit painful.
Thank you for this advice. Now, if we switch on to our market segment, what key factors of the European economy are you paying attention to right now, and why is that?
Well, there are a multitude, but the most important thing to remember about Europe is that Europe is first and foremost a trading nation or trading bloc. If you look at the share of gross value added or employment derived from export and manufacturing, it is approximately twice as large in Europe than it is in the United States. So Europe is much more sensitive to the fluctuations of the global industrial cycle than the United States are. So that's kind of the general framework. So in practice, what does it mean? Well, spend a lot of time looking at China. And right now, the Chinese economy is not doing well, which is clearly a headwind for European growth. Spend a lot of time looking at the US economy, because it's a major trading destination for European exports. And while the US economy is faring well right now, this is mostly about the service sector being strong. If you look at retail sales in goods, CapEx, all those things are slowing in the US, which often lead to lower European exports to the United States. So that's definitely a bit of a headwind going on. And I would say that in the near term, the biggest problem is political, namely the US election, where Donald Trump is reviving, in a sense, his trade war. And while I firmly believe that Europe and the United States can arrive to a trade deal down the road, in the near term, we know how Trump proceeds. He uses high-pressure negotiation tactic, which means that he's willing to cause pain to achieve his deal. And for now, it is all about tariffs. Tariffs in most macroeconomic models cause a big increase in uncertainty, and we can easily understand this uncertainty right now. If you're like a big tire maker and you're thinking about building a factory that will cost you 500 million euros, well, it makes sense to wait a little bit in terms of getting clarity on the nature of the relationship between the US and the euro area before you're gonna deploy all those funds. So this uncertainty that's very high right now creates a headwind to global trade, to global manufacturing, and to CapEx in Europe. And all of that suggests that we are in this environment where growth is weakening in Europe, where risk premia should be high because of all that uncertainty. Hence, we are in an environment that is negative for the euro and that is contributing to the very strong underperformance of European risk assets vis-a-vis US ones since the fall.
And talking about the current situation in the US, President-elect Mr. Donald Trump talked about ending the war in Ukraine.
Yeah.
What would be the impact of this on the European economy?
It's a good news for Europe that he wants to put an end to the war in Ukraine. It's a good news for many reasons. First of all, on the economy, it's not that important anymore. The truth is, Europe does. The price of natural gas has gone from 300 euros per megawatt hour to roughly 40 euros per megawatt hour. So there's been a big adjustment there that has already taken place. But we do see signs that there is a risk premium embedded in European assets to compensate for the risk that the situation could degenerate in Ukraine. So ending the war in Ukraine is good news for European assets. Now, there is likely to be a lot of hand-wrangling from European politicians that, oh, we're abandoning Ukraine and so on. But behind closed doors, there's gonna be a lot of appreciation to the end of this war because it's a costly war. There's a decline in the support of the European population when we look at polls for long-term support for Ukraine. So maintaining the status quo is becoming more and more politically onerous for European governments. So while they're going to complain publicly, we think that they're going to welcome it. And so that's a positive sign. Another thing that's important is that when we think about the trade relationship between Europe and the United States, we know the US are going to put a lot of pressure on Europe. And we know that the US has already put pressure on Europe to kind of separate itself from Russia. And here it's very important because it also means that with nat gas production climbing in the US, and it's going to climb further based on the policies of Donald Trump, we're likely to see an environment where the US is going to put a lot of pressure for Europe to buy that natural gas that the US produce. And that also is a good news for Europe because Europe needs natural gas.
And if the war was to end, how would you see the trade relationship between Europe and Russia after the war?
In the near term, it's going to remain cold. In the long term, it will not go back to where it was because Europe is aware that Russia used natural gas as a weapon. And on top of it, the Russians are also fully aware that Europe and the US use sanctions as a weapon. So the relationship is not going back to where it was. But we do believe that there is likely to be, over time, a warming up of the relationship between Western Europe and Russia. Probably some modicum of flows being reestablished between Europe and Russia. But in reality, that doesn't even need to happen because Europe right now, based on estimate from Shell Energy and Rystad Energy, is building so much regasification facility on its coast that over the course of the next 2-3 years, LNG will more than 100% fulfill the total European imports of natural gas from 2019. So there's not even a need for Russian natural gas, to be frank, in Europe soon.
Do you think there's anything about the European economy that is misunderstood by most people right now? Or do you think that there's something about the European economy that you think the media and the markets are putting too much emphasis on?
So yes, there is definitely something that is misunderstood about Europe. And it's productivity underperformance. So we read a lot about how Europe has a productivity on the performance vis-a-vis the United States. And it's absolutely true. And a lot of the explanation is attributed to structural factors, which are correct, by the way. It's true that Europe has a high degree of market fragmentation, which creates a lot of impediment for large firms to emerge. You have a lot more micro firms, which means that the economies of scale necessary to generate the cash flows demanded to do a lot of capex to the same degree as the United States is not present in Europe. It's also true that the nature of financing in Europe is a handicap for investment and especially to R&D. If you compare the US to Europe, in the United States, financing, banks account for 20% of financing. In Europe, they account for 80% of financing. That's because in the US, they securitize all the credit. So that creates an environment of much more risk aversion. The capital markets are less liquid in Europe, so it's not a center for the recycling of global savings. So you don't get the same VC industry in Europe as in the United States. That is a big source of funding for R&D and a lot of things that in the long term are very productivity enhancing. So all of that is true. But if you look over the course of the last 15 years, there's been a widening of the productivity differential between Europe and the United States. And that is not related to the structural factor. And that's what the press misunderstands. Though this worsening of productivity in Europe is cyclical, it's not a structural factor. It reflects the fact that since 2012, approximately 2013, Europe has been adopting fiscal austerity. So fiscal austerity depresses domestic demand and on top of it depresses income for the private sector. And Europe, during that time frame, also tried to execute a deleveraging of its private sector. So the private sector tried to cut its debt load. And cutting your debt is really difficult when your income is already hit. So when both the private sector and the public sector try to increase their savings, which is what austerity and debt deleveraging are, it creates an environment of very depressed domestic demand. So why is this important? Well, when domestic demand is weak, you have low return on invested capital, and return on invested capital is a huge driver of capex. So Europe had a very low level of investment, in big part because the private sector was trying to save more, and the public sector was also trying to save more. That also, by the way, increased the dependence of Europe on China. Because if domestic demands were so weak, the only outlet for European industrial production was China. But China turned out to be weak too. So that contributed to that very low return environment that weighed on capex. And when you don't have a lot of capex, that hurts productivity. That's all your classical economic model will show you. In the US, that was a very different picture. The private sector debt deleveraging ended very quickly after the great financial crisis. The government abandoned fiscal austerity very quickly. And in fact, since Donald Trump became president in 2016, the US embarked in kind of an orgy of fiscal spending. And you can explain very well the difference in investment rates, in rates of return on capital, on the return on stocks, based on those fiscal and debt dynamics. So in my opinion here, when we look at austerity, Europe versus the US, we're starting to switch role where the United States is being more constrained and not able to constantly expand its deficit, which is what it's been doing since 2016. Europe, on the other hand, is showing signs of changes when we look at the German election. The private sector in Europe has rebuilt its balance sheet. It's flush with cash. The banks are healthy, finally, after decades of being unhealthy in Europe. And the private sector also has a lot of liquid assets on its balance sheet. So we believe that the debt deleveraging is over in Europe. So in this context, I would expect domestic demand to start to recover in Europe, rates of capex to improve, and productivity not to fully converge to US level, but to lose some of its recent handicap versus the US.
And how would you say different technologies that are gaining more and more space in our economy, such as AI, how do you think they'll affect productivity in Europe?
So with regard to the technological developments, that Yes, mostly take place in the US right now, AI and so on. They are positive for productivity everywhere. The applications of AI should be highly enhancing of productivity. And here, what excites us the most, it's not large language models like ChatGPT, Claude, or Gemini. It's actually the small language models that can help a lot with the pharmaceutical development, development of new materials, finding engineering solutions for problems, etc. So we do believe that Europe has a lot to benefit from those technology in terms of its manufacturing sector, its chemical industry, which is still very, very large, its pharmaceutical sector, which are all great beneficiaries of AI. On top of it, Europe has a disadvantageous demographic profile. It has a very aging population. It's not warm to immigration. By the way, neither is the US anymore after the election. Even places like Canada are shifting on this front, so in some ways they're becoming more European than anything else, which means that Europe could face labor shortages on a structural basis, on a go-forward basis. However, thanks to AI, thanks to robotics, which are becoming more and more prevalent, and thanks to the fact that we see a lot of scope for a revival in CapEx in Europe over the course of the next 5 to 10 years, we expect European productivity to start improving because of all those factors, and also narrow its gap vis-a-vis the United States. So yes, Europe has not come up with AI, but we do believe that Europe can benefit a lot from AI, even though it's not where AI emerged.
To conclude this market segment, you talk a bit about AI. Are there other trends that you're excited about or looking forward to 2025 and beyond?
Well, 2025 is going to start very rock and roll because Trump is likely to front load the trade war. I think Trump has learned a big lesson from 2018 when he started his first trade war, which is that you want to inflict the pain early in your mandate. Because Trump, you may not like Donald Trump for a variety of reasons, he is extremely smart at understanding the electorate. And Trump does realize quite well that if he will do the methods that he normally uses to get a trade deal done, it will inflict pain on the economy and especially on asset markets. So it's much better for Trump to front load that pain early in his mandate so that the economy and asset prices can recover by the time of the midterm election in 2026, and especially for the presidential election in 2028. So we think that the painful part of the Trump agenda is coming first. So we are likely to see a very volatile environment at the beginning of the year that will favor the US dollar and favor US assets, even if they fall in absolute terms. Now, what I think is getting exciting is beyond that, I think we're very much toward the top of the US dollar. And this is very important because when the US dollar appreciates or depreciates, it has huge consequences on the relative performance of the US versus the rest of the world, of commodity prices, emerging market assets, and so on. And undeniably, for the last 14, 15 years, it's been all about the US. And that's been the dominant trend. We wanted to be in US sectors, US assets, etc., etc. However, US assets right now are furiously expensive relative to the rest of the world. That's where you see the most crazy valuation. I mean, in absolute terms, they're expensive, but relative to the rest of the world, they've never been as expensive, which means that there is a euphoria that the US, it's true, has grown faster, but that it's only going to grow at an accelerating pace relative to the rest of the world. And I'm highly skeptical about that. I think that, as I've mentioned, the productivity gap between Europe and the United States is overdone. That's point number one. Point number two, the policies that Donald Trump wants to put in place involve some degree of austerity. If you listen to Scott Bessent, so the nominee for the Treasury of Secretary 333 plan, he's talking about cutting the budget deficit to 3%. That means a lot of fiscal austerity in the US, which will be a big change compared to the last 10 years in comparison to the rest of the world. That has a big implication of US growth versus rest of the world growth. So that also is something that could drive the dollar lower. On top of it, Trump is likely to push for policies that will boost domestic demand in Europe, in China, etc., so that those guys buy more US goods. Stronger domestic demand in those economies means that interest rate can rise relative to the US, and that's going to bring down the dollar. And if the dollar goes down, that's wonderful for the rest of the world, because according to the BIS, there is roughly $17 trillion of foreign currency debt issued in US dollar. Now, granted, a lot of it is hedged through dollar cash flows, through derivatives, but there is still roughly $5 to $7 trillion of foreign currency debt issued in US dollar. So if the dollar starts to depreciate, it's great for the rest of the world because it cuts the cost of capital for all those firms that are outside of the US. And it helps global growth and it helps non-US assets. So I think that one of the big trends that we should start to look for beyond the volatility created by the trade war is that the mega outperformance of the US relative to the rest of the world is probably long in the tooth and going to reverse for the remainder of the decade.
Just before we switch to our mentorship segment, you mentioned a possible trade war in 2025 between the US and Europe. What do you think are the main leverages that Europe can pull to increase its negotiating power against the US?
They don't have many levers. They're going to have to deal on Trump's term. But the reality is that Trump's term are likely to be positive for Europe. Because, again, Europe, over the last 12 months, has recorded a trade surplus of $175 billion with the United States. So the truth is that Europe is essentially running a mercantilist policy with the United States right now, which is bad for domestic growth. And Europe can do a lot of things that are good for itself that will please the United States. First is increase its spending on defense. Europe hasn't spent its 2% target on the NATO forever. And Europe wants to spend more on defense right now. So it's definitely something where Europe and the US can get a deal. Buying US commodities is another thing that is positive for Europe. It helps Europe decrease its dependency on Russian commodities, providing ample supply of nat gas in Europe, which means that electricity prices, which are very elevated in Europe and creating a problem for the profitability of the European industrial sector, can start to normalize. And that is something that is good for Europe and good for the US, since the US sells the nat gas to Europe. Policies that increase domestic demand through deregulations and so on are good for Europe as well. So ultimately, I don't think that Europe has a lot of direct lever to pressure the United States, but it does have a lot of benefits from, it can receive a lot of benefits from doing a trade deal with the US. If I really want to push the argument about the lever, we always talk about how China has $1 trillion of treasury bonds in the US, how Japan has $1.2 trillion of treasury bonds. Europe together, all of Western Europe, has $2.75 trillion of treasury bonds. They can sell that.
Now we switch to our mentorship segment. What course of action or necessary skills would you recommend developing to a student wanting to pursue a similar role as yours, and how do you develop those skills?
The first one is clearly to be willing to work hard. At the end of the day, I wish I could tell you that it's all just pure inspiration and so on, but it's not. It's perspiration, first and foremost. So you need to be willing to put in the hours. You need to have some ease with math. It's something that is important because you don't want to fall for the trap that you can think, oh, well, computers do everything. Sure, they do everything, but if you understand the pricing relationship, if you understand statistics like that, it's easy to spot mistakes. It's still easier to spot opportunities. even if you do quantitative investment, and yes, it's based on a lot of programming, well, you can build better programs that will spot the mispricing for you if you have that knowledge. So that's very, very, very important. The other one is to start developing an interest in the market. At the end of the day, you want to go in your first interviews and be able to show some logic about how you think about the market, the interplay with the economy and policy. So you need to go beyond what you learn in classes and start reading the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, spending a bit of time on Bloomberg's. Invest ideally, like even if you don't have the funds to invest, run simulated portfolios. Lots of banks and brokerage allow you to do that because it forces you to start learning how to read the tape, how to link how various economic developments, company announcement, etc. impact asset prices. And like that, you have something that is interesting to tell in their interview. At the end of the day, when you think also about the interviews, all the CVs, like I do run a lot of interviews for the firm where I work, all the CVs you're going to get, there's going to be a big packet of CVs where everyone has very high GPAs, have relevant experience, etc., etc. So what you're going to demarcate yourself from is that you're able to convey some passion toward the topic at hand. So that's the other thing I really recommend, is to start getting interested in it, start dabbling your toes into real investments. Even if it's small money, there's an expression in market participant, amongst market participants, that when you start investing, you might make a bit of money at first. Beginner's luck does play a role, but very quickly, you're going to lose all that money. And we refer to it as the tuition fee for being on the market. So that's the other one. And the third one is make sure to actually have a good time when you're in the university. Because once you start working, you're really going to have to put your nose to the grindstone or whatever the expression is. So do have fun when you're in university. Get the party out of your system, because you ain't going to have much time to party after.
And to finish this episode, we have a few rapid-fire questions for you. So these are questions that can be answered in only a few sentences. The first one is, what is the best piece of advice that someone has ever given you?
The best piece of advice someone ever given me is actually from my wife, who used to work in private equity and completely changed her career to become a sociologist. So huge difference. And her advice is that when you think about the career you want to follow, think about, imagine what your typical Tuesday is going to look like. Any typical Tuesday, any typical day, doesn't matter which day really. Research a bit the industry you are trying to go into. And if their typical Tuesday doesn't look like the typical Tuesday you think you can handle, don't go in that industry. So that's, you need to be realistic. A lot of people go in finance thinking that it's going to be lots of fun and you're going to make a lot of money and you're going to be set for life. You need to survive it, because it is demanding. You're going to be surrounded by a lot of people that are motivated, that are willing to work a lot. So you need to be able to see whether or not you can do that, and that you have enough interest and enough, you know, talent in the skills you need to know. So that's the best advice I've gotten.
How would you describe a career in one word?
Work.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how important would you say your GPA was as a student?
8.
If you wouldn't be in the financial industry, what would you be doing instead?
I love music. I would be doing something linked to the music business. Now, the reason why I didn't do the music business is that while I love music, I don't have much talent in music. The truth is, I've played violin. I sound like when I play violin as a kid, but I do love music, and it's a genuine passion of me. Now, I lacked the vision when I was younger, and I didn't realize that I could have still been in the music business, but in the business side of the music business. So that's probably where I would have ended. And that's also a big lesson, I think, for other people. Like, sometimes you might have passion that you really love, and you feel like, okay, I'm not a 7 foot tall basketball player that has immense talent, but I love basketball. You can still do your job in that field. You may not be on the basketball court, but you can still do something in that field. So you can be creative to transform your passion into your career.
And to end this interview, is there any book you'd recommend to our listeners?
Oh, there are many, but for finance, I recommend a few. One that is highly humbling and that actually says that what we do in the financial industry is a waste of time. It's called A Random Walk Down Wall Street, but it is still a very, very important book for finance. It brings a lot of very important concepts. Another one is A Reminiscence of a Stock Operator, which is a book about trading, about a guy at the beginning of the 20th century who made and lost multiple fortune, and he talks about his relationship to the market and things like that. Great book, it's a classic. Another one is The Money Game by a guy called Adam Smith, not the Adam Smith, it's actually a pen name, which shows that the role of psychology in markets, because what it talks about the market in the late 60s, but all what it talks about is still relevant today. And that's the fascinating part about psychology in the market. And then for a more serious book, quote unquote, about the role of technology in the market and the economy, it's a book called Engines That Move the Market, which is really about the evolution of innovation and its role in market returns. And fascinating book that holds a lot of lessons for investing.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's super appreciated, and thank you for your time.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the episode. If you enjoyed the show, don't hesitate to follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Take care and see you next time.
The sole purpose of this podcast is to educate and to inform our listeners. It is by no means a substitute for professional guidance by qualified experts. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute financial or other professional advice or services. Instead, we encourage you to discuss your career options, as well as financial undertakings with other professionals who specialize in wealth, securities, and asset management, or any other field of financial services. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at a personal and individual risk. This podcast should not be considered professional advice. Guests who speak on this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. The views expressed on this platform are personal opinions and only, and should not be construed as financial advice for a given situation or from a given institution. While all attempts are made to present accurate information, it may not be appropriate for specific circumstances, and information may become outdated over time. No firm, nor any company providing financial support, endorses or opposes any particular view or tools discussed in this podcast. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Advertising, which is incorporated into, placed in association with, or targeted towards the content of this podcast is forbidden. This podcast may not be edited, modified, or redistributed. The Corporate Chat Podcast has no liability for any personal activities in connection with this podcast or for personal use of this podcast in connection with personal websites, computers, or playing devices. Moreover, the Corporate Chat Podcast makes no warranty that this podcast or the server that makes it available is free of viruses, worms, or other elements or codes that manifest contaminating or destructive properties. McGill University and our sponsors expressly disclaims any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or other damages arising out of any individual's use of, reference to, reliance on, or inability to use this podcast or the information presented in this podcast.